Committee for Wednesday, February 23rd, 2005. We are hearing House Bill 5061, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. We are opening without a quorum. I do expect to have all of our members here this afternoon. And with that said, good afternoon, Director Menace.
Madam Chair, thank you, and it's, again, a privilege to be in your committee. I don't see the piggy bank readily available, but I'm sure the Sergeant-at-Arms will appear should I be in violation of any of the acronym prohibitions, so I'll put some cash on the table. But, Madam Chair, members of the committee, yesterday there were a couple of questions that came up that you'd ask us to respond to. The first one, I believe, had to do with a 21st century look at training for public safety officers and, you know, who is doing it right in the nation. We don't have a written document to provide for you right now, but I did bring my talking head here, who's Mr. Eric Scablis, the deputy director of the agency, who's been with the agency for about 14 years, and I think he can give at least some history on the origins of the direction we're going towards scenario-based training and why we're doing what we're doing. So if I could, with your permission, turn it over to him to talk about what the origin of this training modality is and why we're doing it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Sammy. For the record, my name is Eric Gablix. I'm the Deputy Director at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And yesterday you asked a very good question, which is where is Oregon on a national level with the training we provide for public safety? But for the discussion, I think I'd like to narrow it down to the police training because we're obviously looking at the increase to 16 weeks. The true answer is that there isn't a one-size-fits-all answer to this based on different states, different legislative requirements, but truly the biggest change that's happening in the country and what we're trying to incorporate in with the 16-week enhancement program is a change in the philosophy of how we do training. And the best example I can give is that our program in the past was truly a lecture format, where students would be in a classroom 30 together, and they would learn all about the law. Then they would get the next subject, maybe vehicle stops. Then the next subject, defensive tactics, and then they'd go into the gym and learn defensive tactics in different pieces. That's worked well, but the downside to why that hasn't worked is because at no point do the students put all the pieces together. And where we're really going with the new academy and the 16-week enhancement is to tie the classroom learning also with the practical application. So they can go into a scenario where they may pursue a vehicle and then stop that vehicle and then encounter someone at that vehicle stop that then they have to make a number of decisions on whether it's use of force, what level of force, whether it's no force. Perhaps that person has speaks a different language. Perhaps they have a mental disability. That officer would have to engage and basically problem solve right there in a training environment under the supervision of not only instructor but also safety officers and evaluators that are then judging them how they do. So that really has been the missing element. Currently, under our current system, we use Camp Adair just outside of Corvallis for firearms. It's an old military range, but when students go to that range, they know all they're going to do is shoot at targets. They're never going to encounter a suspect. They're never going to have to problem solve. So it's really one-dimensional. With where we're going with the 16-week training with the scenario-based flavor, we're really able to add dimensions to that so that not only are we seeing how they apply the law, but then how do they speak to that person that they're encountering? Are they problem-solving, whether there's a language problem, barrier, the mental issue, maybe a disability, those type of things, as well as what do they do then after that? You know, do they take the appropriate action? Then do they document what they've done in a report, which, as you know, that it's not just taking care of the problem at that time, but then it's seeing that whole incident through the criminal justice, if that's appropriate, or through some other avenue. So that's really the gauge of where we're going in our program. The models that we're using, and if there's a best practice to this, there are two, and they're both federal in nature. The one that has done a very good job is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police up in Canada. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, for all intents and purposes, is a federal police force. They handle customs, they handle local law enforcement. They handle basically a lot of the things that our federal agencies here do, such as Secret Service, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, United States Customs. But in Canada, those are all done by the Mounted Police. They are able to take months and months and months to train their new Mounties to be a police officer in that service, and they have implemented this scenario-based training model. They have probably just as many staff assigned to the academy, or half as many staff as students, because of the intensity involved in this problem-based learning application. And you'll see when we get into our policy option packages that there is a cost to doing this training, because it is not one instructor and 30 students. It's sometimes two students, one instructor that's overseeing this, because of the liabilities attached to actually using weapons and things like that. The American model also comes from federal agencies. The Federal Law Enforcement Training Center down in Glencoe, Georgia, which trains federal police officers, whether they're working for Customs, the Secret Service, for the Federal Protective Service, they have also gone to this scenario-based training model. Again, it takes a lot of facilities and a lot of resources, but what they're seeing there is actually the ability of their students to problem solve early, and not just pass tests and not just demonstrate skills, but actually tying all those pieces together and demonstrated objectives. The other two federal partners that do the same type of work are the Federal Bureau of Investigation with their academy in Quantico, Virginia, as well as the United States Secret Service and their academy in Beltsville, Maryland. Again, those are very specific agencies. Obviously, the Secret Service and the Federal Bureau of Investigation have a very targeted mission, but they have also gone into the scenario-based approach.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. That's not all the ones that do that. I've been through some of that.
Okay.
But I'm surprised. I went through it in 1990. I'm surprised that the police forces have not been doing that. I went through DIA and CIA.
Okay.
Defense Intelligence Agency and Central Intelligence Agency.
and Madam Chair,
I thought about this when you mentioned, I think you casually mentioned it yesterday, but, risk scenario training, you're sort of defeating the justification for your bigger, larger facility.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, on the two agencies you mentioned, we did not have access to those facilities when we did our work, and I think we'll understand why with the security nature of those two organizations. But really, the new facility, the challenge that we have is that we have to provide training in vehicle operations in high-speed situations, which takes a large percentage of that new facility as a driving course. We also have a firearms facility, as well as an area we call city streets, which will allow us to do a lot of the scenario-based training, but then we also have the academic and housing facilities. So as we get further in our budget, and hopefully we'll get a chance to invite you over and give you a tour of the new facility, you'll see really how it seems like a large increase, but the acreage gets used up pretty quick when we move the scenarios.
Follow on, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
I guess you're looking at electronic uses, too, as far as guns and weapons and all that, because the military has some excellent background there that you could look at some of their technology and their programs as far as the...
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we have actually benefited a lot from the restrictions in technology from military applications coming over to the public sector. Later next month, we're going to be working with the Chiefs Association to have a legislative day, and we're going to bring over one of our new simulators that some of you may have heard about. We call it Range 3000. It's actually an interactive use of force decision-making simulator that projects images onto a screen where then that officer has to make decisions in a very quick amount of time whether they take action or not and what action it is and then defend that action. And sometimes those screens may have a person with a child that pulls out a weapon. Perhaps sometimes they turn around and have a screwdriver. The next time they turn around and have nothing in their hand more than a newspaper. So we have benefited from that. Currently we do a lot of regional training with that equipment. We do have 7 of those deployed across the state plus 1 at the academy. But there is a significant cost to that. But we do benefit from that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for that overview. It's very helpful to our understanding.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And again, Representative Wisnett, I think we are really benefiting from a lot of the technological uses that have been developed by the military that are most recently released, and there are versions now available to law enforcement agencies. Range 3000, if I understand correctly, we are the largest user of Range 3000 simulators in a regional training program in the nation. And that is a new program. Since I've come into the agency, we were able to identify some savings internal to budget and purchase these these machines so that they can be taken out to the regions, really in response to the training issues that you maybe heard a little bit more about with respect to use of force. What we're trying to do is get these folks in more frequently in real-life scenarios and get that training to them. But I do want to underscore at least the training modalities that we're engaged in. There are some other reasons for it. One is a classroom lecture, perhaps what you hear from us today in an environment that we're in. You may retain roughly 2% of what you hear in a setting like this, but in a scenario training basis, you'll retain about 80% based on the research. So the scenario-based training really helps integrate that training. So we have classroom, we integrate it into scenarios, and then hopefully it becomes part and parcel to how the officers will respond when they're faced with similar situations on the street. So with that, I'll get back to my goals. If
that's great, and I'll let the record show that we have a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We left off yesterday. We've got two goals here to finish up on, and providing a comprehensive outline, online management of training records. This is an area within the agency that has been a bit of a challenge in terms of technology. We have a limited access system where agencies around the state can view training records online, but they currently cannot change, amend, or add to their training records. And it is an area where we would like to move to a place where agencies can work with us in concert to keep those training records active. And we oftentimes have challenges matching up our paper records with the electronic records. So the ability to maintain that workload and accuracy of those records is important. Again, it goes back to the litigation issues that come out in trial oftentimes when a police officer takes a specific action. Oftentimes they will subpoena the records for that individual's training to determine whether or not what's stated in a police report is in fact documented or justified and shown to be true in their training records. They've in fact had a class on search warrants, development search warrants, etc. The last goal is improvement of communications for the agency, and that is both internal and external. It's important for the committee to understand that we have not only a large constituent base of student population from varying groups, but we also have roughly 140 chiefs of police around the state and their command officers who likewise believe that they have an expectation with respect to whether they can get a student into our academy classes, whether or not they're getting the kind of training that their community expects. And we have 36 sheriffs who are elected in the state, and they have other expectations. Oftentimes elected officials have a different view of their ability to command and control what state agencies or municipal governments may or may not do. A little bit of difference between the two. So we are constantly kind of pulled on and pushed on by these various groups to perform in various ways. So we've got a large sphere of individuals that really are asking us to perform well, to communicate well with them, and to make sure that our coursework is relevant and consistent with their expectations. And quite frankly, it has not been the case in the past that the agency has done a very good job in relating well with those groups. We've done some things internally to try to bring the executive committee of the board into the discussions with respect to the direction of the agency, the reasons why we're moving in certain directions, so that they're part of the decision-making process. And I think that is consistent with Chapter 181 of the Oregon Revised Statutes as you look at the interrelationship between the board and the agency itself. We also train Department of Corrections personnel, OLCC, Oregon University System campus security, animal control officers, parole and probation officers, and a myriad of other individuals, all of whom have supervisors and bosses who have expectations of us with respect to the quality of the training. So the last thing is communication internally, inside of the agency. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to see what's going on with DAS, and we have the DAS Department of Administrative Services. I hope you had much. Intranet within the state's communication system, but there is a development of an intranet system that our agency is looking forward to try to use to better communicate internally what we're doing We have 80 full-time staff members currently, 350 roughly part-time instructors that are part of our organization that we have a very difficult time communicating with in terms of keeping them on task and understanding why we're moving in a particular direction. So the internal communication is also an equally important aspect of where the agency needs to move forward. If I can, and this is a fairly long part of the presentation, I'll try to condense it down in terms of the history of the agency. 1961, House Bill 1590 created the Advisory Board on Police Standards and Training. The board set minimum standards for law enforcement in Oregon, with the exception of the Oregon State Police, and that is an important distinction. They were separate from and remained separate until a little bit later in our history. The first basic course for police was conducted for 2 weeks, October, at Camp Withicum in Clackamas County, Oregon. From 1961 to 1967, the board trained city and county law enforcement officers, and the basic police course was increased to 3 weeks in 1964 and 4 weeks in length in 1967. 1968, the Police Standards and Training Act, 1968 Oregon laws, became effective January 1st of 1968, deleted the advisory nature of the board, and made police officer training and certification mandatory. And I might just go back in my history in training in criminal justice. There was also something that came out from the Congress in 1968. It was the Omnibus Crime Control Act, 1968, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. And there was, at that time, a very strong push to professionalize law enforcement officers. And there was a real movement at that time to try to get general education and college level education to police officers, and try to attract a new type of police officer, if you will, as opposed to some of the folks that were coming out of the military and serving in police agencies around the country.
Madam Chair,
Senator Winters,
wasn't this also about the time we were involved with some of the riots and some of those other kinds of things that was happening across the country?
Absolutely, Madam Chair and Senator Winters. I believe in Portland in 1967, the Albina area erupted into a riot that burned a number of stores. It's kind of one of the latter riots after Los Angeles and other areas around the country, Chicago. Madam Chair, if I can continue, in 1969, the board was granted the ability to revoke certifications of officers. Of course, it was supervision and command executive levels were introduced at the time, roughly 1 week in length. In 1970, the basic police course increased to 5 weeks in length, and the supervision course became mandatory, and three levels of certification were introduced for officer certification. In 1971, there was a House Bill 1179 that provided for a penalty assessment to be levied against all fines and bail forfeitures, with the proceeds to be deposited into, and the legislature created the Police Standards and Training Account. This fund became the source of funding for the board, and agencies sending officers to training were allowed to be reimbursed for salaries of the officers. That is ORS 181690. That section of the Oregon Revised Statute still remains today, authorizing the agency to reimburse local governments for sending people to the department, but that was not funded in subsequent legislative sessions, I think, due to cost. And it's also, I think, I want to note that the current criminal fines and assessment that you may hear, CFAA, or if I could use an acronym with the permission of the chair, CAFA, often referred to, is the outcome of that, the criminal fines and assessment account, which then migrated into a number of various variations, with a certain amount of the money coming to the general fund or to public safety agencies, and it's changed over time. I think in the governor's budget, as it's submitted, you'll see that the governor treats all of the CFAA money or criminal fines and assessment account monies as general fund. In 1971, also, the board assumed direct operational control of the Oregon Police Academy at Camp Withicum. In 1972 to 74, brought changes as training classes lasted longer, facilities changed, and this is important too, women became involved in training provided by the board. The first female police officer completed the basic course in 1972. We did attempt to dig through our archives to try to figure out who that was, and unfortunately we don't have the name attached to any historical record that we can find immediately. But it's fairly significant because I was in the Air Force in 1972 and transferred out of the regular Air Force into the Oregon Air National Guard and became a police officer in Portland in 1976. But when I came out of the United States Air Force to go into the Guard, I was told that you couldn't become a police officer because I wasn't tall enough. And at that time, the Portland Police Bureau had a height requirement of 5'9", and the Oregon State Police had a height requirement of 6 feet. I'm 5'6" tall, and hence I went to an apprenticeship at Willamette Iron and Steel Company as an apprentice machinist until I decided I wanted to become an attorney, which I have never achieved, and went to Portland State University. Then finding out that women had sued, and our culture was changing, and that because women were successful in their suits for access to careers, hence short people like myself, were subsequently also admitted into to the career field and became a Portland police officer December 29th of 1976.
And just for the further illumination of the committee, Director Minnis, I'm wondering if that was Penny Harrington, formerly Penny Orazetti, was the first...
We would, Madam Chair, we would have to do some research, digging through some archived boxes, which we may still possess.
Just a little curious. It was 1971 was the year that I was granted an internship with the Portland Police Bureau, working in planning and research. And my task was to conduct the first study of police overtime practices. So as you're reciting the history, it's taking me back, taking me back as well.
But, Madam Chair, I think the point that I want to underscore for the committee is that the times do change and our culture has changed, and hence our training also needs to change and become more proactive in terms of how we're training people in our current culture and environment. And there have been technological changes that have also changed the course of public safety and investigations, that the areas that we don't currently train in, that in the future I personally would like to get to. But let me, if I may, continue that in 1975, the Oregon Police Academy firing range was completed at Camp Adair. Polygraph licensing law became effective, mandating certification levels for all individuals performing polygraph or lie detector examinations. It's another terminology for that. City and county corrections officers, school district officers, mass transit police were brought under the jurisdiction of the board in 1975. And we had a little bit of a discussion because I went through the academy in early 1977. The academy was 8 weeks long there. I think we have a reference a little bit later saying it became 8 weeks in 1986, but I don't believe that's accurate because mine was 1986. Also in 1977, Indian Police, Railroad Police, Port Police, and State Parole and Probation Officers came under the board's authority. The first one-week basic dispatcher course was held in 1977, increased to 2 weeks in 1978. First basic parole and probation course began in 1978 and was 4 weeks in length. And then here's where it's mentioned, declining revenues in the 1980s. You may remember there was a major fiscal crisis in the 1980s. It was very similar to what the legislature of the state of Oregon has gone through in the last 4 or 5 years here. It forced the board to cease the salary reimbursements to agencies attending the courses. That, again, is ORS 181690. Basic police course was increased. Well, I'm going to strike that reference because I don't think that's right. Corrections course was increased to 5 weeks January of 1986. In 1987, the criminal fines and assessment account, or CAFA, was established by House Bill 2080, which is this, you know, subsequent revision of the earlier law previously referenced. 1991 legislation added telecommunicators and emergency medical dispatchers to the board's mandate. The agency's name was changed to the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, BPSST. Also that year, the new police memorial was dedicated to the Oregon Police Academy in Monmouth. If you haven't seen that particular memorial, it is housed in front of the building on the campus of Western Oregon University. Our plan, just as a side note, when we have a... you keep wanting to use the word celebration, but a memorial ceremony every year in May for fallen officers that is has been attended at least the last 2 years, and the governor has been the keynote speaker there. The memorial obviously has a tremendous significance to persons and families who have suffered a loss in the line of duty. When we construct a facility in May of 06, our plan is to literally pick that memorial up and do a processional with that memorial to the new site and make it part of our memorial ceremony. And in addition to that, there's a little footnote that there isn't a part of our 1% art contribution in this facility is going to include a fire service memorial that will be situated nearby the public safety memorial for law enforcement officers.
Madam Chair, the site... And I hope you could all get to attend the site that is designated for the memorial is absolutely serene and beautiful. I've been there before. I've been there when we were, you know, having our discussion about citing this, and not only that, but about the, some of making certain that the neighbors were okay with the citing and some of those kinds of issues. So I've had the opportunity to walk the grounds and to see where they're going to place the memorial.
Director Menace, would you also make sure that the committee is informed of the time of the, and date of the May ceremony?
Madam Chair, I will. Absolutely. And Madam Chair, also with respect to Senator Winter's comment, the area that she's referring is an area that was formerly owned by the Department of Corrections. We currently lease that land for $1 for, I believe, 100 years with an option to purchase for an additional dollar. Which I haven't exercised yet. But the area is really a very nice park area that the Department of Corrections has used for many, many years. Our intent is to retain that area as a park area that would be continue to be available for the Department of Corrections and Department of State Police and our agency and others that might use it. If I could continue just briefly, I'll try to sum this up. 1993, in an effort to consolidate public safety training and certifications functions under one agency, the Legislative Assembly transferred the Fire Training Section and Fire Standards and Accreditation Board from the State Fire Marshal's Office to the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training. The functions and members of the Fire Standards and Accreditation Board were added to those of the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training. By the way, our board is currently 24 members, with representing all of these various disciplines and public member. Other significant changes in 1993 included the Oregon State Police Officers and Special District Officers in BPSST certification. And if you recall earlier, the Oregon State Police were not under the jurisdiction of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. They are currently under the Department's jurisdiction as it relates to training, and hence the discussion yesterday about the integration of the two academies. Also in 1993, I'm not responsible for that particular piece of legislation. I happened to have been in the legislature, but was the co-chair of the Joint Ways and Means Committee at the time, so I had nothing to do with those decisions, just in case somebody might suggest I did. But the 1995 legislation was passed requiring BPSST to establish a training and licensing system for private security providers, and that is the Private Security Act. In another section of our agency is strictly fee-based. In 1997, the agency's constituency had grown to over 32,000 public safety professionals. In recognition of the significant growth, the Legislative Assembly granted the agency full agency status and renamed it the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, while retaining the governor appointed the board, the Public Safety Standards and Training, to provide direction on the policy issues related to standards and training. So the governor appoints the board, the governor also appoints me, and in 1997 the legislature directed the agency to implement a full delivery of a 16-week basic police course. Department of Public Safety Standards and Training increased basic police course to 10 weeks in length from its previous 8 weeks, but has not been able to expand due to restrictions on our current facility, and that will be alleviated at least at our current schedule right now. January of 2007 is the first 16-week academy class that is planned. 2004, the construction began at the Oregon Public Safety Academy, located at 4190 Almsville Highway in Salem, and anticipated completion by July of 2006. And Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, our structural steel is about a month and a half late, but just arrived a week ago, and they're out there doing steel erection right now as we speak, and working very, very, very hard on that. So, and Madam Speaker, that pretty much concludes the general history of the agency, and if I may turn to the affirmative action report for the agency.
Representative Hannah has a question.
Just a quick question. Where is Almsville Highway if we're not from Salem, just if we want to drive by?
The easiest way to get there would be to just take State Street out to Lancaster, turn right, and Lancaster, follow it south, it becomes Almsville Highway.
After you cross the 126?
Highway 22.
22.
Right. Just beyond 22, it becomes a two-lane road. It goes south for about half a mile and then turns left past the gravel pit, becomes Almsville Highway, and you just head up the highway. You'll see the Marion County Jail on the left side, Santiam Correctional Facilities on the right, and if you'll just go up to the top of the hill, you'll see all of our construction there, and just beyond is the Oregon State Correctional Institution that is over off of Highway 22.
Okay. Thanks.
Madam I'll share, if I may, the affirmative action report for the agency. Department of Public Safety Standards and Training Affirmative Action Plan provides for goals, policies, objectives, and programs, activities related to the equal employment opportunity, et cetera, et cetera. I guess what I want to do, I'm going to sum this up for you. The bottom line is we don't do very good here. And we really have a challenge that is related to the agency's ability, not only internally in terms of the personnel that we're able to hire, but also in terms of what we mirror the populations of police agencies around the state. The recruitment of minorities into law enforcement, public safety careers is a very difficult task, and I think that's the bottom line for the report. If I can cut through the report for you, what I would like to turn to is, I think, a bit of good news for the agency. We're going to continue to try to do what we can to recruit women and minorities into public safety careers, but many of those elements are out of our control, in that the pool of individuals moving into public safety careers is becoming smaller on a national level. Oregon mirrors that, and likewise recruitments for those careers are diminished, and we literally have very little control over what agencies outside of the department do to recruit individual officers. And on an internal basis, we do believe that once we move to the new facility in South Salem, that we'll have a few more opportunities to recruit women and minorities into our training programs themselves. The other thing that I'm trying to do is build partnerships with agencies around the state, particularly the Portland Police Bureau and others, so that those particular agencies know that they're welcome to participate with us, and that we're not working against them, that we're really working with them and for them, and welcome them into our midst to participate with us as trainers alongside each other. As it relates to our construction, if I can, we set a very aggressive goal for the construction site with Hoffman Construction Company to try to do a couple of things. One, make sure that... A question?
Did you wish to ask?
Yeah, I wanted to ask John a question, because I know both that John's sensitive in it. Both, and that John also, actually, we attended the same school, not the same time, and so I think he understands the dynamics when we talk about people of color and what have you. And John, just from your perspective, why do you think it is so difficult to be able to recruit? We've heard the same response when we talked to the Department of Justice. What is it that's out there in the culture and the environment and the dynamics now that you think is posing some barriers, or the reason that we're having such difficulty?
I think there are cultural issues within public safety and paradigms within public safety that need to change. And speaking very frankly with you, I think even within my own agency, to some degree, I'm viewed as an outsider. And partly because I'm a political appointee, in some instances, people take umbrage to the fact that I'm a political appointee. Some people within public safety take umbrage to the fact that I spent 27 years with the Portland Police Bureau. And there are issues even inside of law enforcement and public safety where we discriminate against each other. And it is a culture that tends to ascribe value to things that probably are not very important to the average citizen. And although I could probably find some research that would support this and maybe document it, I'm actually going back to some of the work that I read in college back in 1974 and 75. There's a book called The Ambivalent Force. You sure may remember that book. But there is a culture within law enforcement that ascribes value or credibility based on whether or not you've achieved certain things, whether or not you've achieved 25 years of service in law enforcement. I know police officers who, frankly, would refuse to retire, even though they should, because they had certain issues going on either medically or psychologically in their lives, who refused to retire because they hadn't finished 25 years and they would have to retire out on a medical. That is a significant emotional impact to a police officer. There are folks that seem not to believe that you're a real police officer unless you've been shot, or unless you've been shot at. or unless you've shot someone. And it's a cultural problem within law enforcement and public safety that I think only is going to change with access to a broader understanding of who we are as people and as a system. One of the things that we do internally, and I think, I don't know if I referred to this book yesterday, but the book Emotional Survival, which I want to get a copy for all of you, and I apologize, I was actually going to bring them today, deals with some of the issues of emotional survival for police officers. Police officers, public safety workers, have a tendency to become over-invested in their careers. It's not unlike an emergency room physician or a legislator, for instance, where you are totally engrossed in and committed to what you do to the extent that you exclude the external areas of your life, your family, your community, your faith, and other people around you. And police officers tend to shut down. And they tend to become over-invested in their work while they're on patrol. And quite frankly, physiologically, there is an adrenaline dump that occurs constantly while police officers are patrolling the street. And when they go from, you know, 0 to 60, there's an even larger dump of adrenaline. And there's a relationship between that adrenaline rush that occurs in a street police officer and their untimely and early deaths. You know, the average length of life after retirement generally tends to be about 5 years. Now, it's actually growing because police agencies are responding and trying to do more with the psychological impacts. But when you ask the question, it's interesting because I am fighting internally in our agency to try to relate corrections with dispatch, with parole and probation, with police, with sheriffs, and there is a substantial amount of parochialism, and I think some unhealthy assumptions and paradigms that we possess internally. And I think it's, Senator Winters, when you ask me the question, what do you think the barrier is? I think partly the barrier is internal. I think that the public safety needs access to, one, adequate and consistent training, better access to higher education, and a balanced perspective on in life itself. And I think that in doing that, they will perhaps attract more people of color and people from minority groups who might find the career attractive, because I think, unfortunately, we tend to promote what we permit, or we permit what we promote. And if we permit some form of barrier or building of barriers internal to our career, it unfortunately transcends who we are as individuals. So, you know, as we're looking at building what we're building, it's not just a physical structure of buildings, brick and mortar. And as I've admonished the agency internally, we're going to have a great venue to do what we do, but we have to grow to a level where we can accomplish what we're being asked to do by the legislature. So it really is a heart issue with me. That we're able as a state agency to respond well and hopefully change or impact the culture of public safety in Oregon and become a leader. And I think the nation requires it of us. I think our culture is changing. And I think, as a side note, with the advent of terrorism being a very real situation that is relevant to our culture today, it raises some very significant issues for American law enforcement. I wrote a note here earlier. There's a book by Jonathan White called Defending the Homeland. The premise of the book is, does American law enforcement ultimately transcend into a national police force? Does the work of law enforcement change from what it currently is under our current constitutional democracy, where small governments have small police agencies that control what goes on in their communities and they have autonomy, or do we ultimately transcend into an organization of police agencies that gather intelligence information as opposed to doing police work in the community? So we have significant challenges within law enforcement as a nation in the advent of terrorism, but also I think as a growing pain for who we are as a nation and in our culture, and as we accept more people for who they are. But I think there are lots of things that we can do as a Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to facilitate communication with our communities. Again, I think when we talk about officer-involved shootings, use of force issues, clearly there are things that we can do to relate to the community before a traumatic incident or a deadly physical force situation occurs that can preclude the kind of travesties that we see sometimes in the media when an agency does not respond well in dealing with those situations. Long-winded answer to a very short but very complex question.
Well, I knew that I would get a response from you. I asked that of my former senator and colleague because I actually know how sensitive he is really to this particular issue. And if anyone was going to give a lot of thought to it, it would have been John. So I just...
I appreciate that, Senator. Madam Chair, with the construction, if that's okay, we've set a very aggressive objective with the construction project. And with the cooperation of Hoffman Construction Company, we set this goal of 15% of minority women business enterprises participating in the construction of this new facility. And to date, we have two different issues or two numbers to report to you. I think you'll see it on page 7 of the report. The last paragraph says, on our construction project, the construction manager, construction contractor, or CMGC, Hoffman Construction, is utilizing numerous minority women and emerging small business subcontractors. The goal of the project is to achieve 15% participation subcontracted work by these firms, and the subcontracts awarded to date, it says, is 9%. Have been certified as such. We have a bit of a problem with the 9% because it's not accurate. If the measurement is based on how much money is flowing of the total project cost to these businesses, then the 9% at the time this was written is correct. The actual figure today, as it relates to the total dollar amount of the project flowing to these businesses, is now at 18%. However, we subsequently found out that the measurement is not based on the total dollar amount. It's based on the number of minority business and emerging small business employers in relationship to the total number of employers at the project. And if we use that measurement, then we are only at 5%. So we're not meeting our goal in that respect. So I think that to some degree that's good news. I think most of the project has been kept in Oregon for the vast majority of our contractors, including even our contractor who's going to be building the interior of the shooting ranges. Is a company called AMAC out of Portland, Oregon. It's actually an English firm, but they have an engineering firm with about 100 employees in the Portland metropolitan area. But most of those firms building the project are Oregon-based firms. We also have Hoffman Construction Company really deserves some credit here, because when we made the challenge of 15% participation, they went to their subcontractors, their big subcontractors, and said, we're really serious that we want the Department of Safety Standards and Training to be successful. The director is serious about this. And what they've done in some circumstances is actually extended their bonding to some of these businesses who couldn't otherwise bond the project. And it is about a $61 million construction project, and it's very difficult for most firms to bond over $50 million in construction dollars. Madam Chair, I don't know if you have additional. We have listed our two-year plans, six-year plans, and agency goals with respect to the affirmative action
issues. Just a comment about the two-year plan and the six-year plan, Director Minnis. If you haven't already done this, I would encourage you to consult with Peggy Ross, the Governor's Director of Affirmative Action.
Yes. Actually, she has been involved with our organization as it relates to the construction
Wonderful.
Project.
She is just a uniquely gifted person and very well connected with individuals, organizations around the state who can help you flesh out some of the detail on some of the strategies around your two-year and six-year plan. I'm particularly looking at the sixth bullet under the two-year plan, recruiting through contact with professional women's and minority organizations
okay.
to promote awareness of employment opportunities, but also around the other bullets. She would just be an excellent resource. So.
Thank you very much.
And I would also just say on the record what you already know. I offer myself as a as a resource and someone you can continue to consult with around your efforts to bring diversity to the organization. And like Sooner to Winners, I really commend you for your commitment, which is an internalized commitment, and it's reflected in the fact that you have set goals around the construction piece. I mean, we work with state agencies all the time and over the years who have not seen that that is a part of their work or that it's one of the opportunities for bringing inclusion to how services are delivered. So, again, just an opportunity to celebrate the quality of leadership you bring in this area. And I also want to say that I appreciate that you've said right up front, we don't do a very good job here, because doing better starts from recognizing where we are. And it's that kind of candor that helps us move to the next stage. Senator Devlin?
Madam Chair, I had a question that was not actually related to affirmative action, but was related to the construction of the facility.
Okay.
And it was a question basically of curiosity. When an agency such as yours, which is a relatively mid-sized agency, when you have a project of this size, who actually manages the construction? I mean, particularly if an agency has not really constructed anything before.
Madam Chair, I will be very blunt or upfront with you. In this instance, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is the agency that is managing this construction project. Would I advise that to be the case in all circumstances? I would suggest that probably not. My understanding is that it was a decision of the prior director to move in this direction. In fact, I had a conversation with Lori Warner, the interim director of the Department of Administrative Services, just last week about the issue of the materials and the skills and or the personnel necessary that would be required to do the job or this task at this level. And one of the things that I suggested was that it's probably difficult for an agency of this size to actually deal with it. Madam Chair, that is my phone ringing at my foot, and I humbly apologize to you. And I thought I put it on stun. I know that because it's vibrating.
The reason I ask the question, I'm sure that you're making the inquiries, Madam Chair, that are necessary in terms of assisting you with that responsibility, and I have no doubts of your capability. But it's been my experience in public entities that one of the real areas where you can get into a lot of trouble is the management of major construction projects. If you don't have the personnel available that understands some of the pitfalls of that process. And particularly, I mean, this is not as the same in the sense that this is brand new, but particularly when you get into issues of rebuilding existing structures and stuff, and the amount of things that can come in as change orders and everything else, sometimes they far exceed, or they can exceed, major portions of the project. And there actually are a lot of dollars to be saved in terms of how projects are managed. So,
Madam Chair, if I could just let me speak to that issue for just a minute, because Senator, you are absolutely 100% correct. When I took over the agency, one of the things that I discovered was that the finances of the construction project were separate from and had been segregated and outside of the purview of the business director who oversaw the financial operations of the agency itself. And for whatever reason, the prior director kept those completely separate. And as you know, by statute, when a new director takes over an agency, there is an audit of the agency to make sure that things are in line. I also asked the Secretary of State's office to come in and audit the construction project to make sure that there were no issues that needed to be discovered after I took control. And they did audit and did come back with some suggestions for the agency with respect to the construction manager, construction contracting exemption process that exists within the rules or statutes for building facilities. And I don't know to the extent that the committee is familiar with that process, but it is one that I've found to be very useful for our agency, because you're very much correct, Senator, that if you go a traditional low bid or hard bid model, which is what the state statutes, I believe, mandate up front, unless you go through the exemption process, you do end up in that very situation you described, where change orders can eat your entire budget alive. The CMGC, Construction Manager Construction Contractor process, is an exemption that you have to go through and define a public purpose and have a justification for. There's a public hearing process, and the Department of Administrative Services director must grant the authority for the exemption. But once that occurs, a relationship with our contractor is very unique in that they become our partner in the construction project. They actually come in and bid the project based on what's called a guaranteed maximum price, and they will bid a guaranteed maximum price for everything that comes under the umbrella of that construction, or that GMP, or guaranteed maximum price contract agreement. So in our case, when I came into the agency was moving down the path of having a low bid or hard bid process. It's my belief that given the direction we were going and the oversight of that project at that time, had we continued down that road, we wouldn't be building the project today. It was very fortuitous that I happened to meet a gentleman by the name of Richard Ross, who worked for the Department of Corrections and has built the last five prisons within the Department of Corrections under this construction manager, construction contractor methodology exemption process. And we were able to get him to agree to come over and become our employee in the agency, and he has been really a remarkable person who has pulled this together very rapidly. But the point I'm trying to make is, had we not had the opportunity to meet this gentleman, had he not been available, we would have been, for lack of a better phrase, up a creek without a paddle. We would have been here, I think, having a lot of explaining to do, because the expertise that, Senator, you refer to is not necessarily resident in the state's a pool of employees, to my knowledge. Now, there are great people in facilities at the Department of Administrative Services, many who do have experience there, Bill Foster and others, the state architect, who are great people, and they do have some experience with it. But when you send that project management responsibility to an agency, there's also a corresponding need to have the right people with the right expertise who can also help manage and relate that project appropriately. And the other thing that you mentioned, Senator, very important, is having an appropriate audit trail for the conclusion of the project, because most, if not all, of these projects are in fact audited by the Secretary of State's office. And again, had we continued down the road we were going, I don't think we would have been even close to passing an audit, and I think we would have been in deep kimchi, deep trouble. But I think that Richard's experience with this process and his accounting methodologies, familiarization with how to document and do business justifications for change orders is helping us. I think to date we have three or four changes to the project so far. We've actually kept that to a minimum.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Wilson if he'd like to comment on this.
I just wanted to say that the reason I pointed this out, it's been my experience in about 20 years of serving in different bodies, that this is one of the areas where you can really do things well or you can really do them poorly. And you really don't want to do them poorly, because they become very public issues when you do them poorly.
Madam Chair, that's absolutely right. In fact, just a brief comment. Remember the archives building? I subsequently found out with that issue, it was a CMGC construction process. And one of the things that we committed to in this process was, because the uniqueness of the relationship is that the general contractors oftentimes can find savings for you within your budget, within that guaranteed maximum price. But the decision apparently was, in that circumstance, was to take some of those additional savings and upgrade the carpeting. We've committed to not do that. And, you know, you have to have a justification for adding things back in that meets that test.
Mr. Wilson.
Well, Mr. Minnis touched on it. I was just going to say that one of the first things that the director did when he came on was recognize is inexperienced in that area and hire Richard Roth. I would say he stole him away from corrections, but he may have a different view of the transaction between DOC and DPSSD. We have Department of Corrections.
Madam Chair, that's also sometimes can be viewed as a crime in this environment. Director of Minnesota Legal Swiping Personnel from other agencies, but we commend you on what you did. And I also commend you on the contractor. That's a local Salem firm who I was out when you did groundbreaking, and I know that you hit the ground running. And I just appreciate how quickly you transitioned from writing legislation and getting it passed through these halls to actually building this facility. You've done a lot in a very short period of time.
Madam Chair, one of the things that I tell my leadership team in the agency is I'm not smart enough to run this agency by myself, and I'm not even kidding. So bringing people on who do have expertise is fundamentally important. I do think the issues relevant to construction of buildings and such is it's worth some time asking other agencies who have built buildings what their experience has been, and it's not really trying to detract from anybody within agencies that may govern or oversee those things. I think the state really could benefit by focusing on having the right expertise in place in different, so that they can consult and advise agencies as they go through this process, so that the decision making is done right the first time. The last thing that I learned in as it relates to the affirmative action issue, the bonding issue is an important construct. Many small businesses, minority businesses, do not have the capacity within their businesses to bond these kind of projects, and in some cases even participate in the bonding of these projects. And to the extent that the legislature can find a solution to that, it would be very helpful. I do believe that you would find more businesses in this classification that would be willing and able to, if they felt it could bond the project. But it is a unique barrier to their ability to participate.
I appreciate you sharing your learnings around the construction piece of the project. I wrote down as you were speaking something that you wound up saying yourself, and it's a quality of leadership. Leaders need to be smart enough to know what they don't know and must be secure enough to know when and where to ask for help. And that's what you've done in this instance to move the project forward. And speaking of moving forward, where would you like to go?
Madam Chair, with your permission, if we can move to, I believe it's tab number, is it two? Okay, tab number two. I did it. I included an additional insert that is not in your book, but there was a reference earlier to the population of constituents that we serve. Our 2002 employment data shows that public safety constituents, including private security right now, is roughly 36,000, so it's growing. Projected employment in these areas to the year 2012 is 41,004, according to the Oregon Employment Department. So if I could now try to go through a program summary for the agency. The agency is currently located at Western Oregon University in Monmouth, which we referred to before. The new academy is under construction at 4190 Almsville Highway in southeast Salem, and our operations are expected to move in mid-2006. We are trying to forecast actually shutting down our training operations at the academy site, the current academy site, for approximately 2 months to transition to facilitate movement to the new facility.
Senator, are you leaving any component of training or any activity over at the Monmouth site at all?
Madam Chair, Senator, once we have actually moved from one site to another, the answer to that would be no. At least it's not planned. There was a previous plan, I believe, to have a regional training presence there, but that evaporated, I believe, a couple of years ago. We can have more discussions about that, I believe, in phase two, if you want, on the finances and transition plan. We currently have four regional offices that are staffed units, staffed by Criminal Justice Training Coordinators and Fire Training Coordinators in Bend, Central Point, Cornelius, and Pendleton. And Madam Chair, I've had the experience of, and actually it's very profitable to travel the state and visit with a number of the public safety managers around the state and get a sense for the difficulties that they're facing, and it's very unique. Perceptions in law enforcement are also unique. Some people have a perception that if you're a Southern Oregon or an Eastern Oregon police officer or sheriff, that somehow you're perhaps not as sophisticated as people in the Valley. But quite frankly, my experience is that's not true. In fact, John Courtney, the chief of police in La Grande, Oregon, I believe spent 16 years in L.A. County Sheriff's Office in California, and the chief in Cannon Beach is a retired captain out of Tucson, Arizona. Police department. So actually, among those agencies, there is a depth of experience that exists. Criminal Justice Training and Certification Program. The purpose of this program is to train and certify to the appropriate levels of competency all law enforcement officers, corrections officers, parole and probation officers, telecommunicators, and emergency medical dispatchers. And the program has historically been funded primarily through the criminal fines and assessment revenue stream. The governor's recommended budget, as mentioned earlier, shifts those revenues to the general fund or considers them as general fund, and the total recommended limitation for this program is $13,963,366. Target groups include approximately 7,900 law enforcement officers, and I looked at the data for 2002, and that number should actually be 8,735 in the law enforcement category, projected to grow by about 10% to 9,600 or 9,693 in 2012. There are 4,050 corrections officers, 650 parole and probation officers, 1,000 telecommunications workers, and emergency medical dispatchers, 70 polygraph examiners, some in public safety agencies and some in the private sector who are also coming under the jurisdiction for licensure purposes. The other thing I want to mention is that among law enforcement, of the law enforcement personnel that we currently certify, all of them, 100% of them, are employees or being paid by an agency to perform the work that they perform. In the fire training certification program, the purpose of the program, of course, is to train and certify the appropriate level of competency. Volunteer and career fire service personnel, as mentioned yesterday. The program is funded by the fire insurance premium tax, and the total recommended limitation for this program is $2,727,793, again, from fire insurance premium tax money, and there is $52,992 in a federal grant. Target group, approximately 11,600 fire service personnel, and the agencies, of course, that employ them. And again, in this instance, over 90% of these individuals are volunteers, as mentioned yesterday, and not paid professional workers. So we really have a flip-flop in terms of the constituents that we serve here. Law enforcement, mostly paid personnel. Fire service, mostly volunteer. Private security program, the purpose of the program is to maintain and enforce established standards for training and certification of private security providers and provide training for industry managers and instructors. Our revenues are fees paid by private security providers supporting the program, and the total limitation for this program is $1,057,952. Target group is approximately 500 firms with an average employee base of 7,800 private security staff. And I'm sure the legislature, if you've served on the judiciary committees in the past or others, you'll find that this can be a relatively controversial section of the agency from time to time. I do believe there are a number of bills introduced this session that try to address some of these issues. The Public Safety Memorial Fund, the program provides benefits to family members of public safety officers who are killed or permanently or totally disabled in the line of duty. Since its creation in 1999, the Memorial Fund has been supported by the criminal fines and assessment monies. Again, the governor's budget considers those monies as general fund, and the total recommended limitation for this purpose is $236,338. Those directly impacted by this program are currently the beneficiaries of 18 law enforcement officers killed or disabled on line of duty. And indirectly, the program impacts law enforcement officers, corrections officers, parole and probation officers, and fire service personnel. And this is a program that, in my opinion, is one that I think the agency is going to have to pay some attention to in the future because the the legislature, I believe it was in the 01 session, added the language permanent total disability. I believe that we're finding more people applying for benefits under the Act with that language, and it's a bit of a conundrum for us right now to try to manage that, and it's just an area that I want to highlight for the committee that I'm not convinced that we have the expertise in-house to perhaps make some of those determinations, and we need to perhaps look at that and work potentially with the Department of Insurance and Finance.
Is that the correct term? Consumer and Business. I'm going back a few years, I think. Consumer and Business Services. And I have had some discussions with Corey Streisinger, the director of that agency, about some strategies that we might employ to try to deal with what I think are some potential liabilities that we may have outstanding years. The Administration of Support Services Program includes the Director's Office, Human Resources, Information Systems, Business Services, Facility Operations, and Debt Service for the new Oregon Public Safety Academy. And I should note, Administrator Representative Hannah, we do have a little chart here to hand to you on the COP issuances and dates of those issuances. The functions included in the criminal justice program through 2003-2005 biennium have been funded again through criminal fines assessment account monies, but again are treated as general fund, and total limitation for this is $22,191,726, which does include the debt service component part of the governor's recommended budget. The program impacts four other agency programs, all public safety agencies and officers, private security firms, employees, vendors, contractors, citizens, and so on and so forth are affected by the decisions that we ultimately make.
Let me stop you there for a moment. Representative Hanna, did you want to follow up on the certificate of participation issue?
It was a question from yesterday that we had some discussion about, and I was looking for the schedule of debt retirement of the COPs and maybe when they were sold, and I think we're probably going to get that answer.
Touching up the thing.
Just to close the loop on that that question, is that something that needs to be copied for the committee?
I'm afraid it does, unfortunately.
Okay, that's fine. We can do that.
I apologize for not bringing copies, but I can just read into the record if possible. 2002 Series D sale was a $4,280,000 COP. The date of the sale was May 2002. The end of the debt for that issuance is January 11th of 2012. And debt service on that is $1,131,285. 2003 Series A sale was a $5 million COP issuance. The date of the sale, March 2003. The end date is 5-1 of 2028. Debt service is $681,595. 2004 Series A, again $5 million, issued or sold June of 2004. The end of that is debt service is 5-1 of 2028. Debt service is $758,520, and in 2004 there was a Series B sale, $20 million, sold in October of 2004, and ends in May 1st of 2030. And the debt service on that is $2,449,688. There is a March projected sale, which is the last sale, for $43,240,000, and the date of the sale is yet to be determined, and we're working with the Department of Administrative Services Facilities. Is that correct? Finance Division. I'm sorry. Mr. Jeffries in the Finance Division to get those dates secured. So we'll provide this document for you, and I hope that answers your question.
Follow-up, yeah. Thank you for bringing that. Does the current listed debt service include the sale of the upcoming COPs, the March 05 COPs?
I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question.
It does not.
It does not.
I want to make sure. He has a figure on page 8 of 11.9 million. That includes the $43 million.
$43,240,000.
Yeah, that is factored into this. In fact, in talking to Mr. Jeffries, there will likely be a savings in the governor's budget of roughly $3 million that they feel they don't need for debt service even without sale, and that would be incorporated into the co-chair's budget in some way.
And Madam Chair, I believe that's contingent upon what the actual sale
right.
interest rate is that's achieved at the time.
Senator
Never mind, he answered the question. It'll depend upon the actual sale.
I want to say it one more time so that I have it right in my head then. The $11.9 million in debt service does include the service for these yet-to-be-sold COPs.
Madam Chair, and Representative, that is correct, but I think what the LFO staff or, let's say, fiscal officer staff is trying to say is that there's an assumption about what that interest rate would be, and the actual interest rate that is part of that sale may be less than. And
right. We're looking at the top of the top rate paid, basically.
Madam Chair, correct.
Yeah. And one further question. On your chart, do you list the bond interest payment, the interest rate?
It does not.
It does not.
We can get that for
you. We can look it up. That's great. I think it's nice that we know that, and then we know what we leave to those who follow us.
Thank you for bringing that information back, Director Menace. And where would you like to go next?
Yeah, sure. If you're good with this, the organization tab number 3. And as mentioned, Madam Chair, previously the agency has evolved from an advisory board, police standards, to a cabinet-level agency, and the board representing constituents of all the public safety agencies previously mentioned. The governor appoints the director, or me, and is directly responsible. I'm directly responsible for the oversight and management of all of the aspects of the agency's operations. The governor also appoints a 24-member board, which establishes minimum standards for employment and training of public safety officers. There are 5 discipline-specific policy committees, and this is an important construct within the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. These policy committees substantively are where most of the work is accomplished within the board. Board's framework. The Police Policy Committee, the Corrections Policy Committee, Fire Policy Committee, Telecommunications Policy Committee, and a Private Security Policy Committee. There is one additional advisory committee, which is the Polygraph Licensing Advisory Committee. The assistance establishing the standards and policies facilitating communication between the department and the board. And local public safety constituency groups. And if you look at the construct of Chapter 181, there is envisioned to be an ongoing dialogue and relationship between the board and the agency's management. In the director's office, I have a deputy director, as previously mentioned, Mr. Eric Gablitz, who provide overall agency administration and legislative coordination. And coordination for the board and policy and advisory committees representing all public safety disciplines. In addition to that, my
Madam Chair, while that's going out, may I?
Certainly.
This is just a curiosity question. Being an appointed director, what's the history of an appointed director's longevity in their role? I mean, given that you could change governors, you could change jobs. Is that correct? I mean, is it at the governor's?
Madam Chair and Representative, that is absolutely 100% true. I serve at the pleasure of the governor. That is a change from last legislative session where the director of the agency served at the pleasure of the board. The governor appointed, but the board offered 3 suggested names. The governor appointed, but once the governor appointed the position, then the board had the ability to dispose of the director. Now, by statute, again in Chapter 181, on a yearly basis, the board is required to report to the governor and evaluate the performance of the director with respect to the implementation of the policies of their directives as a board. And that actually is ongoing as we speak. I'm not sure when that is to occur, but yes, it is completely and totally at will.
Thank you. Well, I will just say this right now for the record. Not having the little crystal ball and knowing what the next election might bring, I just want to publicly say right now that whatever happens in the next election, I will be one who fights to the mat to make sure that we keep this director on board for as long as he chooses to stay on board, so that we stay the course that has been mapped out. We are just very, very blessed to have the quality of leadership that we do, and what we need is continuity. And so I need to say that for the record and for in all seriousness. Senator Devlin?
Well, I was just going to say, Madam Chair, you, given your number of years in the legislature, and Senator Winters, although Senator Winters doesn't have the number of years in the legislature, she's been around the process, have seen, it's literally, and you've seen a lot, it is literally interesting, because you do see a whole lot of directors change with administrations. And sometimes you wonder what the rationale is for all of it. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. But we had a case in this last, and I won't comment much farther than this, but that where we were starting to wonder whether a certain person, I won't say who, how many different departments she could direct.
You didn't have to.
Yeah. I think he knows who I'm talking about.
Representative Hannah, positions that are appointed by the governor Director Minnis is correct. They serve at the pleasure of the governor, and it is not unusual when new governors come in that they select their own appointees, because what they're attempting to do is to put their philosophical imprint on whatever agency. So with that being said, sometimes there is the history where a new governor coming in will keep whoever's there, depending on that, but that tends to be sometimes somewhat rare.
Madam Chair, I do think there's a little benefit to this in terms of new members seeing this. It's not just when governors change. I can recall a time when now Senator Starr was Representative Starr, Bruce Starr, and I were in a I won't say which committee. We were in a committee. We were having discussion with the director of a certain department. There were no indications that there was anything wrong. In fact, the meeting went extremely well. And then about 1 o'clock that afternoon, we had heard that the director had resigned.
It tends to go to the heart of what I said earlier. The governors will look at, he or she will look at the philosophical and where the person is on their particular public policy, and that usually drives the decision of the governors. Having served on a couple governor staff, that was the way that we operate, and I haven't seen any different with subsequent governors, so it's not unusual at all.
Madam Chair, just to kind of in addition to follow up with respect to the history. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I would hope that our good colleagues remain, and of course that depends on who's occupying that position.
Madam Chair, that is correct. And I say the history of the directors previous. The former director, Diane Middle, served for, I believe, 6 years and came in and was appointed after Mr. Steve Bennett was the director at the time. Mr. Bennett, I believe, is serving over in Europe training police agencies. But the history of the agency has, to some degree, required some change agents, if you will, partly because of the reference I made to the cultural issues internal to law enforcement. Our agency suffered a fairly embarrassing issue that occurred under Mr. Bennett's administration that culminated in what's well known as the Ray Teatsworth Report, and had to do with internal utilization of racial epithets that were inappropriate, sexual comments that were made that were inappropriate and had been tolerated within the agency. At that time, Mr. Bennett left employment partly because of those issues, the agency, in bringing Ms. Middle in, I think her charge was to bring some order and some structure to the agency that would not tolerate sexual harassment or the use of racial epithets and so on and so forth to the agency. She did a good job of bringing that structure to the agency. And that's part of my challenge, too, is to ensure that those things do not grow within an agency. Human beings, such as they are, I do believe there's a stewardship that I have or any director would have over those issues. So that's part of the history of why some directors of agencies have changed, and some directors, quite frankly, have changed because they're extremely talented individuals and their skills are necessary in different areas. I am, by the way, subject to the pleasure of the governor. The superintendent of state police, once appointed, is actually not removed except for cause in statute, which is a different construct, but a unique one that I found out about just in the last year or so. But
great question, Representative Hanna.
Madam Chair, you do have, I do want to apologize, I guess, that this is in color. I know that this is to some degree an absolute no-no or prohibition, but it is in color for a specific purpose, and that is to delineate some of the decision packages that you will see, and this represents the decision packages that are part of the governor's recommended budget, so that hopefully you can see that where those positions fit into the overall structure. So. The training division of the agency provides training to the academy regionally and through partnerships with local governments and community colleges. Instruction is provided in basic, advanced, supervisory, management, and specialized training programs. Some of our specialized training programs might be child abuse investigations. From time to time, there are, and help me with this, Eric's specialized training.
Under the regional program?
Under the academy training program. We just recently held one relevant to, I believe, Indian Affairs.
Yes, correct. Dealing with tribal communities.
Tribal communities, excuse me. So there are those kind of specialized programs that do appear from time to time. We have approximately 350 part-time employees, agency loaned or volunteer trainers, most of whom are full-time employees for the state or local public safety agencies, and they provide literally the majority of the instruction in the classrooms or in the skills environments where we do our EVOC, emergency vehicle operations training, and our firearms training, etc. Full-time agency staff and contract instructors, depending on their expertise, supplement the part-time trainers. This is actually an area of the agency that I'm taking a look at to determine whether or not there are some additional strategies that we might use to better enhance our ability to deliver services. I've been in communication with the Eugene Police Department, the Oregon State Police, the Portland Police Bureau, and others to look at potentially having loaned officers loaned full-time to the agency as subject matter experts. As it stands right now, most of them serve as part-time instructors who are paid an hourly wage for their participation. Academy training program courses provided at the Academy include the following: a basic 10-week police program involving, and this is really not comprehensive, it involves ethics, diversity, communication, skills, survival, problem-solving skills, law, and health and fitness. There is a police career officer development course, a two-week training program provided to police officers who have been previously certified in other states, or those who have been out of law enforcement for more than 2.5 years. But less than 5 years, this course provides officers with simply an update on Oregon law and Oregon procedure. There's a basic corrections course, which is 5 weeks in length, consisting of, again, of ethics, cultural diversity, security, human behavior, safety, law, inmate management, and survival skills. And I might add in this particular area that the corrections officer recruitment and the students that we're getting, many of them are pretty raw. Have virtually no experience in criminal justice training. And it's become a bit of a challenge to get a grounding in criminal law or even criminal justice issues because many of these folks are coming from career fields that have no exposure to working in a correctional facility at all.
Representative Hanna.
Can I just ask you, what are the requirements for an applicant for those corrections positions? I mean, if you were talking to students out of high school or community colleges or even from the four-year schools, what are the requirements or the minimum requirements for a corrections position with the state?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, I believe, and Eric's can jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, that you can breathe. You have all of your extremities, generally a high school education, not, I don't know if a GED, I believe a GED is
high school diploma
will work. And
physical,
just a, yeah, an initial physical health test by a physician.
Age? Does it have to be 21?
There is not, well, 18, I believe, isn't it? Or, I think 18 for corrections officers, 21 for police officers. You know, once they pass the background, there's usually a background investigation free of criminal convictions that would be a disqualifier under the rules of the board. And I don't, we haven't talked so much about the rules of the board. There are criminal convictions for which you cannot possess a certification, and others that are conditional
discretionary.
Or discretionary disqualifiers that the board can review and decide whether or not a person should hold a certification. And actually, I think there is a bill introduced this session. I believe the Department of Corrections is behind the bill that would prohibit corrections officers from having sexual contact with persons that they are overseeing. That bill is really, it's an interesting statement, but it is one of the primary reasons why corrections officers are being revoked under our revocation standards, through our certification standards section of the agency. And quite frankly, that many of these folks coming into these careers, I would suggest, are ill-prepared in terms of their... Could you take that outside and kill it? Ill-prepared for the career.
Senator Devlin?
One of the comments about the qualifications... There are a lot of people that would probably exceed those qualifications that are employed. I think Director Minnis probably is well aware in the history in terms of law enforcement also. I can't remember his name, but a former sheriff of Multnomah County was the first sheriff. I don't know if he was the first sheriff in the western United States or the first sheriff in Oregon.
Ebrow.
Yeah, required people to have a bachelor's degree for his department. And some departments have required AA degrees, but there are many departments now that still just require a high school diploma. But they get people that are far more qualified than that actually applying for positions.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely correct. And please don't take from my comments that every candidate coming through the door is as I have described at the minimum level, because we had a candidate come through the police academy here in the last 2 months who was a Harvard-educated attorney. Who is a member of the Portland Police Bureau. And you'll see likewise experience, background, and education in the corrections fields also.
And I did want to comment, Madam Chair, because I have to get this in here. I do see that I think he just got his doctorate maybe a few months ago, maybe a year ago. Steve Winiger is my former chief of police.
That's great. Madam Chair, and with respect to Mr. Weiniger, Steve Weiniger, we actually have hired him. He is a PERS retiree. We've brought him on for 6 months as our training director with a specific challenge to develop policies, procedures, and look at our organizational structure and how well we're doing.
You mentioned Dr. Lee Brown. He was my mentor.
I actually knew him.
I think, in case you didn't know, that Lee Brown, of course, is now Mayor Brown in Houston, Texas, and he actually, at one time, for the members on this panel who don't know, he was our czar.
Drug czar.
In Washington, D.C., as well as he was with the city of New York. So.
Atlanta.
Did he go to Atlanta?
He was in Atlanta. It was during that time of the child murders.
That's right. Yeah.
Madam Chair, actually, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department still does have a 4-year degree requirement to be hired in that agency. Portland Police Bureau did implement a 4-year degree requirement, but backed away from it after a number of years, now still requires 2 years of education. My experience tells me there are plenty of people in public safety who have degrees from PhDs to law degrees to engineering degrees who are serving as law enforcement officers and corrections officers around the state of Oregon, well-qualified individuals. Madam Chair, we also have a telecommunications 2-week training program consisting of civil liability, 911 call handling techniques, officer safety, and hazardous materials handling. emergency medical dispatch class, 16-hour class that provides dispatchers with specific training on how to provide basic life support instruction via the telephone to callers experiencing medical emergencies until on-scene assistance arrives. We also have a campus public safety training program consisting of 5 weeks of training that includes law, college and university community relations, diversity, ethics, and survival skills. This is a carve-out program because these individuals are not police officers, but they have a very, if you look at the Oregon Revised Statutes, campus public safety at the larger universities have one set of statutes and requirements that we certify, and then the Oregon Health Sciences University has a different standard, but neither are police officers. And we have been working with the Oregon University system to try to come together with a construct for a basic training program for campus public safety that's consistent throughout the university. What we find is that the universities all have a bit of a different idea about what campus public safety is depending on the campus that they're involved in. And I believe the University of Oregon contracts with the Oregon State Police for police services.
Oregon State University
with Oregon State Police. And I believe the Portland State University generally has an expectation that the Portland Police Bureau respond to law enforcement circumstances. We also have the regional training program that's been referred to a number of different times, the delivery of mandated, specialized, and maintenance training provided through regionally training assistance of 11 regional training councils, and often are coordinated efforts with resources of the cities and counties, state and federal training partnerships. Courses range in length from anywhere from 1 hour in training to 120 hours, includes topics. Skills maintenance training, dealing with emergency vehicle operations. We like to talk about, and I want to try to get this in your thinking, perishable skills, and the phrase perishable skills, because much of what we're trying to do is to keep skills sharp, because much of the skills are perishable if not utilized. Firearms, decision-making, tactical defense tactics, confrontational simulation, a basic detective academy, which is actually an academy that was developed through the Portland Police Bureau. It's really their program that we have sanctioned and work with them on, and I would suggest there is a stronger need to have a more broad and in-depth investigation school at some point in the future. Standard field sobriety testing, instructor courses, firearms instructor courses, flying armed. That's not so easy nowadays to do that, and there is a level of training to teach people how you can do that and under what circumstances it's allowable. Emergency vehicle operations instructor course, field training and evaluation program. Field training and evaluation program is one that's an important component part, because there are some folks out there who believe that once we've graduated a person from our basic training programs that they are a fully competent and capable police officer. And some agency managers would believe that that's the expectation, that once they've graduated, that in fact they are fully competent to do their job. We don't share that view, and neither does the board. We have a field training manual that's developed by the agency, and our expectation is that there is a field training officer who's assigned to supervise and oversee the on-the-job training, if you will, of these officers in the field, so that they can observe and determine how they're doing with issues like report writing and how they're doing with search and seizure issues and other relevant topics that are taught in the academy. Also, instructor development courses. As we said previously, we have roughly 350 part-time instructors who have to go through an instructor certification course. Frankly, at this point, we do the certification for these instructors initially, but we really have no program to follow up and make sure that these trainers are able to consistently teach the current curriculum for the agency. It's an area of concern for us. As we move towards some of our technology-based development, our hope is that we'll be able to deliver to regional training trainers via handheld PDA, which is what is done at FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Georgia, the current curriculum for the training program that they have there. But it's an area where we have some very serious concerns about what's being taught and how, whether they're teaching the actual curriculum for the course. And then, as you know, legal updates every 2 years, the legislature meets and certain criminal laws are changed, criminal procedure issues are changed, and sometimes those changes may or may not be consistent with what's happening in case law around the country or within the state of Oregon, and we have a responsibility to help train and teach law enforcement officers around the state on what the current status of the law is, usually in the areas of search and seizure, use of force, and these kind of topical areas. Or, as you know, I believe the several statutes have been ruled unconstitutional recently here in Oregon. I believe you're dealing with an issue relevant to people holding signs up in freeways and so on and so forth that has been viewed to be a free speech issue. Hate and bias crimes, professional stops, racial profiling issues that are an outcome, I believe, of the 1997 legislative session, child abuse training, missing and abducted children's instructor courses, domestic violence issues, which continue to be a problem, meth labs in children and methamphetamine response to drug situations is one I know that the legislature is dealing with. The governor has had his task force on methamphetamine, and there are a number of bills introduced. We likewise have a duty to continue to train in these areas. If you haven't had an opportunity to look at the governor's task force on methamphetamine and what's going on, it's a fairly comprehensive attempt to deal with these issues. And methamphetamine laboratories seem to be very pervasive throughout the state. First responder to hostage situations, terrorism, and school violence. Active shooter training within a confined area like a school is something that, since some of the more high-profile shooting situations in schools, is something in there.
Madam Chair, question. I had an opportunity recently to go on a drug bust, methamphetamine particularly, and I was with the SWAT team. With the Marion County Sheriff's Department. Do you provide the SWAT team type of training at the academy?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we actually don't provide the SWAT team training, but we do facilitate that training through the regional training network. A good example is that we establish partnerships with not only local agencies, but also the professional organizations and their federal partners in law enforcement. A good example is next month, the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, is bringing a two-week class to Monmouth for people that supervise drug units. That's one of the opportunities that we have where they'll provide the training for free. They need a site, and we do that. But then the other thing that we do is that we facilitate that training so that if a SWAT team is looking for a house, we might use that same house for a firefighter burn alarm training in a few weeks once the SWAT teams are done. So we're constantly looking at things. And just last year, the regional training section did over 600 classes for 11,000 students. So that gives you some idea in the magnitude. But again, they're not doing all the training directly because you can see our staffing isn't that large and regional, but they do broker quite a bit where somebody's offering a class and then they offer it basically to other agencies to come up participate.
Madam Chair, I just for the record, I have to say that the precision and the work that they did was absolutely mind-boggling. I watched and I thought, you know, unlike what you see in the movies, it's nowhere near what we're talking about on TV, and so maybe someday you will be into that as well, because I felt extremely safe that I was in their company, and that I knew they knew exactly where they were going, what they were going to do, and how they were going to do it.
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, that's actually an area that has changed dramatically in the last 15 years in law enforcement and 25 years, whatever. When I came on, we would just go get a search warrant, take a couple of officers and go kick the door in. In fact, North Precinct Knights back in the 1970s, we actually made our own key or heavy-handed door knocker, if you will, to knock the door down. And I stood in a number of methamphetamine laboratories until we finally realized that these chemicals were not good for us. And because of the number of weapons that we're now encountering and law enforcement are encountering on the streets in the United States, it's very different than it was when I started in law enforcement today. So the utilization of special weapons response teams, otherwise known as SWAT, or CERT, I suppose, in the Portland Police Bureau Special Emergency Response Team, those are becoming highly utilized.
more so because of officer safety issues and because they obviously don't want to lose an officer. In our new facility, as we're building it, we do have two 25-meter ranges and one 50-meter range. My firearms instructors tell me one of the issues we're looking at is whether we use leaded or unleaded frangible ammunition or so-called green ammunition. We do know that green ammunition in .223 caliber, which is usually the weapon caliber used for many of the weapons insert or special emergency response team programs, is available in frangible ammunition. So I believe we'll have the availability to do some of that kind of tactical training in the facility that we're building, but not to the degree that it's currently being done at Camp Riley with the Oregon State Police and other police agencies.
Please continue, although I do have a question. I don't see mental health crisis intervention listed. Is that oversight, or is it included?
Well, Madam Chair, as I said earlier, this does not include all of the courses, but mental health crisis training is in that, and I believe I've got a document here that is not copied, but... Well, now, is that taught in regional or not?
Madam Chair, that class is actually covered in two different areas, and a good way to look at this is that in the basic training, we're really laying that foundation where we do provide some information on that, but with the expansion of 16 weeks, we'll provide more, plus the scenario-based training will give us a place to actually do that role-play type training. The other thing within the regional training network is those classes are, we just have really given you a small list of the different topics. We do work a lot with nonprofits and other organizations that host conferences that we broadcast to law enforcement agencies that do not only that issue, but many others. We did a partnership not too long ago with a hospital in Albany on dealing with people who are suffering from medical ailments, and we offered that for agencies in the area. So, again, we're brokering across the state where those opportunities come up. And a big thing to mention is that not all the training that we offer through regional is delivered by a law enforcement professional. There are a number of people that are very talented and capable and have expertise in the areas that are not law enforcement that they can benefit law enforcement knowing that. So we take those opportunities wherever we can find them.
Madam Chair, are you thinking, looking out in the future, and because this is such a big issue, and I'm thinking about a conference that I attended where I believe it's Texas or Austin or one of those states that have made it a part of their package and their training of working with the mentally ill, so that becomes a part of your actual curriculum over time. And I know... we've had these conversations before.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we had a number of years ago looked at a program that Portland had just brought in from Memphis, which was what they called Crisis Intervention Team, or CIT program, where they would actually train police officers in 40 hours of training on how to diffuse and really address an issue dealing with a person with some sort of a mental illness. The challenge at that time was that a lot of the small rural communities just couldn't afford to take an officer away for 40 hours and leave their town in many cases unprotected. But what we did at that time is we worked with the Department of Human Services, and we actually created a four-hour telecourse that we put together, basically a workbook that identified the issues for training, and then a video that basically gave the lecture to agencies across the state so they can do it in roll call type training. The one thing that the regional workbook concept also brought forward was that those local police officers then, or sheriff's deputies, would work and identify what resources they had in their county. And the challenge we have is Multnomah County has quite a bit of resources. Some may argue not enough, others may argue too many, but in other areas of the state, they don't have that 24-hour access line as many of the metro areas do. So it really allowed, through the telecourse concept, the ability for those local agencies to find who's in their area if they have this situation and who they can really use as a resource, not just during an event, but also before and after.
And Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. This is an issue that does need more attention. I think in the basic training program, we're scheduled at least tentatively to go from 3 hours of training in mental health crisis intervention to 8 hours. Again, that's tentative. We also have a two-hour course on critical incident stress awareness, which is scheduled to go to 8 hours.
But we've also been asked by the Oregon State Hospital to consider training their persons for, I don't know, cell extractions, if that's the right term or not. But each time we get a request to do these kind of trainings, it becomes an additional stressor within the agency because we have to expend resources to try to determine what they need in their training and then try to determine internally who has the expertise to train it and then coordinate and set it up. And we're more than willing to do these things, but again, it becomes a resource question. In fact, I just about drove my staff nuts when I came in because I had all kinds of wonderful ideas about what we can do, and I stressed them out a lot about saying we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and you know, I had a very, very, very fertile mind here. But they finally reminded me that, look, John, you're driving us nuts. We're tired. You know, we're very busy. We're tired, and we've got a lot of stresses. And I've had to back off from some of that and kind of get real with them so that when we do get these kind of requests, we don't say no. We say maybe. It really depends, and it depends on the resource. And to the extent that that we're able to do that, but we are more than willing.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For those of you who served on the Ways and Means Subcommittee last session, you'll notice under leadership training, you may recall that leadership training was cut from the budget. You'll see the restoration of that program. When I came in as the director of the agency, I interviewed all of the employees inside the agency and spent a great deal of time talking to chiefs and sheriffs around the state. The one thing that was tantamount on the minds of leaders around the state, chiefs and sheriffs, was the leadership training or the absence of a supervision training program, because under the rules of the board, the supervision training or for supervisors, newly promoted sergeants, required that they have this training, yet the legislature didn't fund it and it wasn't made available by the department. It didn't exist. What I did is took a look at the existing budget and agency structure. When I came in, there was a legal instructor position in the budget that the agency had been trying to recruit for 3 years and had been unsuccessful in finding an attorney who would work at that particular lower salary. I abolished that position, recovered some finances internally, and we have restored that program internally, but it's not the 40-hour program that it once was. It is now it's an 80-hour program, but 40 hours of it is taught by the department, and the additional 40 hours we're working as best we can with community colleges and the various chiefs and sheriffs around the state to give chiefs and sheriffs some discretion over that second 40 hours of training. And what we're trying to do is change to some degree the culture of the agency so that if a chief or sheriff wants to send a particular person who's a supervisor to a community college to take a class in organizational development or management or speech communication or some skill that they can get at a community college, what we're trying to say is that's okay with us. We'll evaluate that, give them a certain number of hours of training for that so that they can get their supervisory certification. And it's really a first attempt by our agency to try to work cooperatively with the community colleges and the chiefs to help them get these certifications. We have a recent development in this area where we did a test program, if you will, a train-the-trainer program for the California ethics training that has been utilized in California. It is a 2-week training program, and we're considering the utilization of that course statewide. It was well received, and the concept is we train trainers around the state. They can then teach that same 80-hour course around the state on their own once certified by the department. So we're, again, trying to expand the ability or access to leadership training, supervisory training around the state of Oregon. In fact, some of the various chiefs around the state have some very, very strong feelings about professionalization. The board is currently working on and have recently addressed, I believe, moved to the full board, the police policy committee. Not yet. The police policy committee is currently looking at requiring a management level certification for all chiefs of police in the state of Oregon. They currently are not required to have anything beyond a basic police certification. And that will ultimately be a fairly controversial issue within the state among various chiefs and so on and so forth. But what has been at least told to me by inference is that Oregon has not done a good job in developing managers of public safety agencies so that
if there's an opening as a police chief in the state, more often than not, the successful candidate is going to be somebody from out of state. From generally California and Washington tend to be very popular. Both of those states have very aggressive leadership, executive development and management training programs. Oregon likewise does not. So one of my efforts is to try to move us in a direction where we are accessing high-level executive development management training, frankly, to deal with some of the issues that we've dealt with before. Fire training. Eric, I'm going to turn this over to you.
And as you're doing that, looking at the time remaining, yes, we have about 12 minutes, and I'm wondering if you can move us through the rest of the organization section in that time remaining so that we can start with performance measures tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, the fire training section, I'm not going to read all the different courses that we do there. One of the things that we need to really think about with fire training as well as regional training are two words. One is mobile, the other one is off-site. Truly the idea there is to take the training to the local communities. The biggest challenge that we run into is, especially in rural communities, eastern Oregon, southern Oregon, even right here in the valley, a number of the fire departments are very small and don't have the ability to go somewhere off-site for training because that would leave their community unprotected. What we do is we take classes to their fire departments. The list is there. Last year we delivered just under 400 classes to fire departments across the state, and the number of students that attended that was just shy of 6,000. We do that in partnerships with not just community colleges, but also the regional training associations, as we spoke about the other day, also the state professional organizations, the fire chiefs, the fire directors, the Professional Firefighters Association, and also some other partners from the federal level, the National Fire Academy. One of the things that we do quite a bit of is, and you may actually pass our vehicles on the road, we have two trailers that are flammable liquids and gas trailers that allow us to actually do hands-on firefighting training at the local fire department. The other thing that we do is that we also assist local fire departments in burning buildings that have been deemed surplus, for lack of better terms. The building's going to be leveled because they're putting in a shopping mall or an interchange. What we'll do is we'll work with that local fire department and go through all the safety and insurance issues of doing that burn alone so that we can have hands-on training safely in an acquired structure, which really is very valuable when you think about firefighters never being in structure fire, having the ability to do that in a true structure. The other thing that I'd like to follow up on, and Representative Wisnant asked us a few weeks ago about our partnership with forestry, we do work very well with the Oregon Department of Forestry as well as with the State Fire Marshal's Office in the wildland interface area, which is training firefighters who protect structures that may be endangered by a wildfire heading toward a community. One of the things that we are working with, and actually I think it's an example of how well Oregon does in its interagency coordination, is that we are on a federal task force with the federal partners, which is the U.S. Forest Service, the United States Fire Administration, and Bureau of Land Management, in addressing just how can we do what Oregon does in preparing structural firefighters to protect communities from wildfire danger, where in a lot of other areas, that state or federal wildland agency truly protects just the nature, the vegetation, and doesn't really look at the structure. So what we're doing here works very well. We're constantly looking at refining our process. But again, hopefully we'll be used as a benchmark on how to really work with the structural agencies and the wildland agencies together is a good explanation of how we do things pretty well here.
Question, 90% of firefighters are volunteers?
Approximately, yes, ma'am.
And so how does that factor into the fire training, who actually gets trained through the fire training?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question, and we actually do a lot of interesting things, and that is that we do a lot of training at night and on weekends for volunteer firefighters because a lot of them, or most of them, are working during the daytime. They may have the ability to leave their job when the siren goes off and if there's a fire called or their pager's activated. But what we really do with our partnerships as well as our direct delivery is look at how we maximize that person's time and put training at their level when they need it. A good example is training fire instructors is a four-day course to be a trainer. What we have done with our staff looking at how do we really stretch not only the dollar for our agency, but how do we stretch the dollar, which is that person's time taking that class, we've created a new instructor class where the first 2 days are taken at home on a computer with a CD that we send them. So all of the lecture they get in their home or at their station at their leisure. Then when they come to the class, they take a pretest that they've done all the homework, and then they're ready to go, and then we just take what used to be 4 days in a classroom, and now we do 2 days in a classroom. So we're maximizing their time as well as our time and really looking at efficiencies in technology.
Senator Winter?
No, I didn't have a question.
All right, I'm going to give you the brief overview, Madam Chair, in the interest of time. The private security section we've talked about quite a bit. The functions, of course, are listed in the narrative here. I won't go through and read them. Human Resources Division. I do want to comment. Again, it's self-explanatory what they do. When I came into the agency in January, quite honestly, we had, a couple of people left. In the human resources section of the agency, the manager in that unit came to me and said that she felt that she'd been perhaps the job had been misrepresented to her, and that she was going to be leaving the agency because the problems were too complex and too large. We have subsequently spent the last year rebuilding the human resources department in the state. We have brought on a woman by the name of Pamela Strawn, who is our human resources director, formerly the human resources director at Bob Repine's shop over at Housing, who brings to us about 32 years of state experience and is a remarkable person who is also leveraging her experience and relationships with the Department of Administrative Services and has brought over some very highly skilled and qualified experienced persons to work with us. And our human resources section is really an area that I'm very proud of today. And they're literally setting the house in order, if you will. For those of you who've been in private business or have been around human resource personnel files, quite frankly, there's a protocol for how personnel files are supposed to be set up. I can tell you that in many instances, ours were not. And there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done. There were about 14 months of worth of filing that had not been accomplished when the former director was hired and brought in. Former human resources director, much of that filing work has been caught up, and they're doing a wonderful job today in preparing for the future in terms of the hirings that we need to do. In the information services division, a fellow Lloyd Lowry is our information services director, who's worked for the city of McMinnville in the past and some other government entities. Quite a remarkable director who has a vision for the agency that we could provide for you in greater detail with respect to how to utilize technology at our new facility as we're being, as it is envisioned today. In the future, the new facility will have wireless internet access throughout the facility with varying levels of security access depending on where you're located. Our hope is that we'll have PDAs or similar types of instruments so that our instructors can actually grade the students in real time and download the results of their various evaluations in real time in our computer systems at the new facility so that we can have constant evaluations and ongoing evaluations both of the students' performance and at the end of the classes, hopefully the instructor performances. It currently stands to be a bit of a weakness for the agency today in determining how well our instructors are actually doing, how well they can teach. In the business services division, we have Elaine Sears, who's seated behind me. And I've got to tell you, in all of the experience that I have with the state as a legislator, as a person in public office, I have never met anyone who is as competent or as capable in the area of keeping our books and our finances in order. So I'm literally would say that if anybody has a question about our finances or about where the accounting might be, I'm very, very comfortable in saying we'll open the books and show you whatever we have. And I think that it could frankly surpass probably anybody's scrutiny in the agency. She's literally the best that I've ever seen. So you'll hear from her a little bit more, I think, when we get into phase two. And I think you'll agree with me that she is she's a remarkable person when it comes to the technical aspects of putting the budget together and keeping the agency in compliance with the Department of Administrative Services and other sections of agencies that help regulate us for financial purposes. The project office, we've talked about the project office a little bit previously, relevant to Senator Devlin's question, and I think hopefully we've sufficiently answered that question. We have three persons, a part-time clerical person, the construction manager in Richard Ross, and one additional person who's facilitating the construction project.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Director, can you tell us how you determined their pay scale, or how was that percentage of the construction project, or is there a classification for that in the...
Wow. Madam Chair, that is a remarkable question. And how I respond to it, I have to be, I'll be very candid with you. When I came into the agency, the fellow who held the project management position was at the same salary level that I am. He received the same salary level I did. Quite frankly, we had some discussions in my relationship with our budget management analyst about the appropriateness of that salary level. I made a decision to remove that person from that position, not based on salary, but based on skill level issues that I felt were not at a level that would get us where we needed to go. And not to say that that person wasn't doing the best that they could, but that person was then brought in at a lower level, took about a $2,000 a month reduction in pay. And actually it was a situation that they offered to me because they were so vested in the project and its future that they wanted to continue with the agency and continue with the project and humble themselves. That was an agreement based on the classification of the job description. And this person provided a job description that was reviewed by Richard Ross, who was brought in to oversee the project, subsequently submitted to the Department of Administrative Services, and the pay was consistent with the classification as it was reviewed by the Department of Administrative Services for that particular classification. And also, if you can, Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, with respect to Richard Ross, quite honestly, I argued for a higher salary for Richard. He was at a relatively high level in the Department of Corrections. I wanted to entice him to come over because I didn't want to lose him, and I argued with the Department of Administrative Services to actually pay him more. I won on a couple of technical issues, and they won overall in terms of what the salary actually was, but again, based on classification and the needs of the agency.
Thank you, follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Minnis, I guess Madam Chair, too, I'd like that we can bring this back tomorrow because we're running out of time and maybe talk a few things because I don't understand the code exactly, and I think it's important. I would like to compliment you, Director Minnis, on contracting out the next section you're going to go to as the food services and those other areas you contracted out for. Why did you not do landscaping? Looks like I know Derek Kitts, Representative Derek Kitts, has a landscaping business. He might.
I'm going to ask you to hold your response for tomorrow, given the time. And I'm going to suggest, colleagues, that with regard to the organizational chart, that we focus on any questions we have around that when we get into phase two. Tomorrow we will finish up any comments that you have, Director Dennis, around the organizational piece.
If I could, just one piece of advice for you. If you want to find out about the classification numbers and the remuneration systems, if you go to Oregon.gov and look up the DAS website and human resources, there is a section there that you can click on that shows all of the job descriptions and the expected minimum qualifications and the proportional salary levels for all of those various positions. So you can do a little of that research on your own if you want to do that. It's accessible by internet.
Madam Chair,
Senator Winters,
before we adjourn, at first I want to, you reminded me that the good director used PDA and DAS, and I really want to thank him for his contribution. Not only has he been prolific at writing bills and legislation and getting it through this process, but to date he leads in the number of acronyms that have been used in this committee.
Madam Chair, I won't make a reference to my being a former senator and my pedantic conversations.
We so appreciate John. You know, sometimes you have colleagues that you work with and you can poke fun at, and they've got a history in this building, and he's one of them, and he's been around long around a long time to where we all feel that comfort with John. And I do want to sincerely thank him for his contributions, because some children will really benefit a lot. And I know that children are a part of John's heart, too, because, you know, he's going to be a grandfather pretty soon.
Chair, if I could get a tax receipt on that, it would be...
Madam Chair.
Representative
Hansel. Well, I apologize for being out of the room so much. I've got a little throat tickle that I thought was kind of annoying. So I watched most of this hearing on TV up in my office, and the reason it's going so slow is the amount of fawning that's going over the director. The only reason I came back was I was afraid they were going to offer you a raise before the end of the hearing. So,
Representative Hannah,
with that, we promised to use some humor, so maybe this is a closing thought. Opposite of the fawning that is recognizable, you serve at the pleasure of the governor, and you're stealing employees from other agencies. Just how long do you want to have that job?
I take the fifth.
On the advice of counsel, Madam Chair, I do.
Madam Chair, before, I did have one thing to say, that it's glad, I'm very glad to have the senior member of the House delegation back here for this committee, the very senior.
Thank you. Order. And Director Menis, we thank you for your presentation today, and again, the thoughts behind the presentation. Thank you, and we're adjourned.